Love 55.
Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the hand of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada. Pleasure to be with you. I think we have both JB and Kirk full house this evening. How are you, fellas?
Good. Good.
I have a question for you. There was two big items in the news this week. One is Cardinal Pell was sentenced to 6 years for multiple acts of rape. He was the third highest ranking Vatican member. And he's just one in a long line that now has been proven that the Roman Catholic Church over the last 50 years has committed some 250,000, just in the West, acts of pedophilia. And the other was that an Aussie, an Australian moron, went into a Islamic mosque, and while those in it were mooning God and bowing before Satan, killed 49 of them. So, I have a couple of questions. What do you think is worse? Pedophilia committed, acts of pedophilia committed by the world's most imposing religious organization. So these would be old men sexually abusing young boys. Or murder.
Well, pedophilia you have to live with your whole life, even though it's, you do live, but you live with that.
Not necessarily, by the way. You know, on Pell's two cases of rape, as is the case very often, being having an act of sexual abuse perpetrated against you, the victim takes their own life. One of the two Cardinal Pell's victims took his own life.
Well, that most of the evidence shows that a lot, most, or not most, but a lot who are molested go on to become molesters.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, it starts a cycle. Yeah, and it's an there is no real answer to the question that I asked, but the reason that I think you were slow to say, well, you know, murder is worse or pedophilia is worse, is they're reasonably equivalent in terms of their being morally reprehensible. So when this lone individual, without any credibility, he's an avowed racist, which means his ability to think is limited to the color of someone's skin.
Mm-hmm.
He's a fascist, which means that economically he has an IQ of a sparrow. He's a neo-Nazi, which means he's ignorant when it comes to history. Mm-hmm. He is a conspiratorial freak. One of those that overtly says the internet is, you know, his videos is where he gets news and that all the rest of the news is fake news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the just absolute idiots that has no filter, no sense of judgment, doesn't know how to use news sources effectively to discern the truth. And he's a Facebooker. You know, we had a terrible experience on Facebook. Now, I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of people who are using Facebook extremely well. There's a Torah study. It's called Shamar Torah. Facebook site that is marvelous. Has lots of people going to it, and that the only subject discussed is I was teaching. But for the most part, that Facebook world creates an artificial world where there are sound bites and videos and images shared and people like or dislike and short little posts. You know, my sole exposure to it was when we were exposing and condemning unpopular truth.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, he was big time hooked on Facebook. That was where he put out his mantra. That is where he broadcast his deadly deed. He was a weapons freak, incapable of using his words. So here you have a person that not affiliated with anybody, never harm anybody again, not smart enough to rub two sticks together to get fire, awash in fake news and conspiracy. And he walks into a mosque and in his artificial world of make-believe, intersecting with the real world, kills 49 people, and virtually every government leader and religious leader in the world spoke out against him and condemned him and showed their sympathy for the victims. Are you aware of any head of government, any religious leader that has come out and overtly condemned the Roman Catholic Church for committing 250,000 acts of pedophilia?
Not one.
Where's our sense of justice?
Listen,
I'm probably as outspoken as anybody in the history of the world against Islam.
Mm-hmm.
The religion is deadly. It's a terrorist scheme. Muhammad was a complete and utter fraud. He was a disgusting pedophile, speaking of pedophiles. He was a rapist, mass murderer. Started the religion strictly to steal other people's money, and today it inspires 99% of the world's terrorist acts. I don't hate Muslims, but I do despise the religion. And yet, every time that I speak of it, I always say the same thing. Use your words, evidence and reason. You want to help the world, you want to help Muslims, you want to make a difference that's positive, use your words. Never resort to bullets and bombs. What this absolute moronic racist did is make the case in favor of Islam vastly superior and made the ability of rational, compassionate, courageous people almost impossible. Because the world outlast is against hate speech,
mm-hmm.
which they would view anything that tells the truth to be hateful.
Yes.
And so it makes it exceedingly difficult to expose and condemn that which our righteous indignation would call us to expose and condemn. And therefore, this idiot made the situation so much worse.
I told that, yes.
Really sad. Mm-hmm. You know, at the same time, there was a story that came out about the Islamic State women. I don't know if you've read that, but they've gone into these communities where the Islamic State still prevails, and the women are so devoted to their terrorist, fundamentalist, Muslim, raping, pedophilic husbands. They're all dressed in tents, but they've got nothing but little eye slots. Otherwise, they're out in the middle of the desert wearing nothing but black tents. The place they live, if you have one of the nice places, then you've got a mud hole carved in the dirt that's 8 inches deep rather than 6 inches deep. There are no structures. They're just abandoned women and children living that way. The women saying that they want to raise their sons to be jihadists. Defiant. And you just shake your head and say, this is the most despicable religion in the history of humankind. And yet now, to speak out against it is going to be prosecuted and persecuted. And at the same time, the Roman Catholic Church seems to get a pass. There is a little bit of good news, but it's not very good news. It's most recent poll, it says that 37% of Roman Catholics have begun to question their faith in the face of the priestly pedophile crisis. How could you only? And that means that there's 60% of Roman Catholics that aren't questioning their faith.
Right.
It's pretty astonishing. Speaking of astonishing, the decision was made to ground all 737 MAXes. Newark plane, it's the world's most popular, world's safest airplane in the history of aviation, is the Boeing 737. The only difference in the 737 MAX, this new version, and the old version, is it has larger engines. It has the GE, is actually CFM, because it's a joint venture with a French company. It has high bypass engines. It's called on that airplane, it's the LEAP 1B. The 1A would be for the Airbus version, the 320neo. The 1C is for the Chinese version of that, essentially the 737 size. So here you have politicians banning the takeoff and landing of 737s, which is the safest airplane in the history of aviation. Yes, there's been two crashes. And the only thing different in this airplane and the airplane that's been made for many decades now is the size of the engine. The engine, because of the nature of the cowling and the higher bypass to make it more efficient, is moved a little bit forward, it's moved a little bit up. It changed the center of gravity of that airplane ever so slightly. And so Boeing came up with the idea of helping pilots in manual mode when the autopilot is not engaged. When the flaps are not deployed, if a pilot goes into a steep turn at slow speed at a high angle of attack, which is a triple whammy in terms of lift, you lose lift in a bank. You lose lift with the high angle of attack, the nose up, and you lose lift at slow speeds. That under those circumstances and with the flaps retracted, you lose lift as well. That under those circumstances, with the autopilot off, Boeing came up with an assist, a software and an angle of attack sensor that would actually push the nose down so that you didn't stall the airplane when being flown under those very adverse conditions, which pilots shouldn't be doing anyway. If you turn on the autopilot, the system is disabled. There's a switch right by the throttles to disable the system as well if you're flying the plane manually and you don't like what the system is doing. In other words, you want to stay in your steep bank, high climb, low airspeed. And the system is disabled on takeoff because the flaps are extended. The system only engages when the plane is being hand flown and the flaps are retracted. Now, Boeing's only failure here was that they didn't put the fact that this new system to aid pilots to keep them from crashing and stalling the airplane, they didn't write a new chapter on it and how it operated and how to disable it and how to detect a malfunction in it in their pilot's operating manual. And it's not part of the training, and they do a simulator training. Should have done that. They didn't.
Yeah.
But they should have done it. Now, you've got an airline that flies, I don't know, like 35 or 40 of them, Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines, 100% of their fleet is 737s. And they have like 35 to 40 737 MAXs. They've taken them off 41,000 times. They've landed them 41,000 times. So that's 82,000 times the airplane has been near the ground where this system, hand-flying the airplane on manual mode off of autopilot, could come into play. 82,000 times. Nothing. No crash. No incident. No accident. And yet, under those circumstances, they choose to ground the airplane as opposed to just putting out a memo and saying, and, oh, by the way, this is how you disable it. And it'll only deploy in these circumstances, and it's designed only to keep you from stalling the airplane. And if it malfunctions, it's right there on the center pedestal, right in front of the throttles. Click the button down. But people couldn't think it through. And instead, they ground the airplane. I mean, I understand they ground the airplane in Iraq. How many aviation engineers do you think there are in Iraq? But in the United States? A lot of things going on in this crazy world that are really tough for me to understand. Pardon?
I said all you need is a little education, not government involvement.
A little education would go a long way. Now, I understand that Boeing is creating a software patch for it and that they will review the sensors they're using for angle of attack. By the way, I am a pilot. I hate angle of attack. I don't mind angle of attack sensors. I don't pay much attention to them. I'd much rather feel the airplane than I would look at a sensor. My Pilatus, which was four airplanes ago, it had a pusher shaker in it. So if the airplane neared stall, it would push the nose over to prevent you from stalling the airplane. And I didn't like it because the only time I was ever in proximity to stall speed is when I was trying to land the airplane. So if I was flaring, say, beginning to flare 10 feet above the approach of the runway, you know, you'd want to occasionally push the nose over. Well, I can't land on the nose wheel. If I land on the nose wheel, I'm not going to ding up the prop and mess up the engine, but puts me in a vulnerable position for a tricycling of the airplane and crashing. And so that's not appealing to me as a pilot. And so there was a disable button on it that you could hold your finger over, your thumb over, and disable the system so you could properly stall the airplane as you were landing. But that is, in fact, what they put on it. But unlike Pilatus, Boeing was smart enough to disable the system if the flaps were deployed, which they always are for landing unless you're in a very unusual set of circumstances. But it's just, again, people in political positions that don't. I'm drawn to this, and it might have been, I know there's some that love the news and to talk about the news because it's such a different viewpoint you get on the news as part of this program, and those that said, let's just go to the tour and bypass the news. But, you know, I've just finished translating Yasha Yaiting and completing the chapter on Yasha Yaiting, and it includes a lot of new material. So for those that might have read the original version of it 7 years ago, there's about 5% consistent with the way it was and about 95% new material. But in it, there's this overt exposure and condemnation of the United States. And there's now, having gone through it, comprehensively, there are 72 references to the United States in the chapter. Some of them played several times, but 72. The first and the opening sentence, there are 22, the same number as the letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And the second statement, there are 50, the same number of states in this country. But one of the constant comments is that America's seem to simplify and trivialize everything. And they're never able to see the entire picture and how the pieces fit together and are prone to react based upon one simple idea out of context with the tapestry of issues that are involved. Like, Saddam Hussein is a bad guy. Let's go invade Iraq. Osama bin Laden is a bad guy. Let's go invade Afghanistan. Well, there's so many other issues that when you don't think them through, you end up creating, not only making a bad situation worse, you squander a million lives in the process and lose your mind and soul and character as a nation along the way. And so it's this propensity not to think things through, to look at everything that's involved. You know, it's America has been so dumbed down that the idea that there were two airplanes, the two 737 MAXs that crashed, and that there were some similarities in their flight profiles, and therefore, rather than looking at it as a comprehensive whole and realizing that the primary flyer of those airplanes is Southwest with 82,000 takeoffs and landings combined without incident. And it's the safest airplane ever made and is easily resolved. They just take one thing out of context. Well, that's bad. And the abundance of caution, we're going to ground them. It's a country that's lost its ability to think. It's terribly sad, and I'm of the conclusion that this has happened to America primarily because of political correctness. It's happened to other places in the world, like those that were, you know, that were Muslims, because religion does this to people. But in America, I think it's mostly political correctness and the reluctance to be judgmental, to exercise good judgment. All right, if you hear me shriek from time to time as we turn now to, yeah, I was worried. Well, I am enthusiastic about it. I did something really bad to my ribs, and I was on the mend, going to a chiropractor on it, but I re-injured them about 2 hours ago, and everything is fine except it's really hard to breathe. So if it wasn't for having to breathe, I would be really in good shape. But unfortunately, to do this program, breathing is a requirement. If I were to laugh, that would be deadly. A cough, you might as well just give me a gun and I'll blow my brains out. So, yes, this is one of those which is not a dull pain. This is the ice pick pain. And it, first time ever it's gone. From all the way through, from under my shoulder blade to under my front in the chest, so it's an ouchie. All right, let's begin where we left off a week ago. The people of these nations, and they're archaic people of these nations, who are massing under a single religious and political leader, Laoma, like widespread and innumerable, horribly destructive and deadly floodwaters, will be devastating and desolating. But he will rebuke them, issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. and so they will be swiftly driven away, denied and deprived of what they sought. They shall disappear, going away into a distant place of alienation. And they will be chased just as the chaff on the hills before the approaching presence of the Spirit. And like a rolling ball of idolatrous dung, spinning like a tumbleweed in a whirlwind before the approaching presence of the storm. In context, this follows Yahweh telling us that Damascus is going to become a twisted heap of ruins, that the Syrian government is going to fall, that the terrorists are going to have driven so many out of their homes, the Islamic terrorists, there'll be no one left there to terrorize. And then the world, to keep them from leaving there, is going to give them what they crave. The West Bank of Israel. That's going to thin Israel at the waist, since the Gaza has already been surrendered to approximately 7 miles, where 70% of the population lives. Israel becomes undefensible. And just as happened when Neville Chamberlain gave the high ground of Czechoslovakia to the Nazis, it invariably and immediately led to world war. In this case, it's going to cause Muslims to seek to invade and destroy Israel for the fourth and final time. And they're going to flood into Israel by the tens of millions, maybe over 100 million, this floodwater. And just before this, of course, there is the Teruah harvest, which is a big deal to all of us.
Indeed.
But it'll be just nothing but a small little asterisk in the history of the world annals up to that point. They'll hardly miss us. And so now what Yahweh is telling us is that he is going to intervene. And he's going to do it his way. Which is that these people who have banded together under a unifying leader, it would be the Mahdi to Muslims, that he is going to lead them in a unified attack against Israel, and that they're going to come at Israel in wave after wave, floodwaters. I'm almost envisioning what the world is going to see, because it's going to be very much like what happened in New Zealand, where if you want to see the carnage, you know, it was broadcast from a head cam, from this head case Aussie that decided that he couldn't use his words anymore, that he had to use his gun. And now with 7 billion smartphones on the planet, this is going to be broadcast to the world. And they are going to see literal waves. You know, as jihadists, and maybe many of you have seen the movies of World War II in defense of Stalingrad. Yeah, where they're just piles and piles of bodies, and it'd be wave after, you know, they climb up the dead bodies, and then, you know, they'd be shot, and they'd fall, and somebody climb over them, and they'd shot into you. Create literally waves, long waves, as they try to, you know, by the tens of millions, come into Israel, screaming Allahu Akbar, wanting to die, because it's the express ticket to Allah's paradise. Now, there's going to be so many of them that the IDF will not be able to stop them. There are not enough bullets to stop them. And unfortunately, Israel has not been very good at using its words. In fact, Israelites, Jews, may be the world's worst at using their words in righteous indignation. And so, unable or unwilling to use their words to expose and condemn this before it happens, they're going to find that their bullets and bombs are inadequate. And so Yahweh is going to intervene. But what this says is that he is going to intervene in a way that begins with a rebuke. I was dealing with a passage. It's second or third last passage of Yeshayahu 18. And he uses a brace of words, a phrase, that's only used two other times in the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And what it had is that it's been speaking of America, and it concludes by speaking of America, and it says that, you know, those who are near and dear to Yahweh are going to bring this nation as leaders to God as a war prize. The nation has been defeated, and its leaders are being brought to God as tribute. And I wanted to do everything I could to render it otherwise. Because even though I'm a big proponent of holding people accountable, that's rough. And then what I came to realize is that it's necessary. You know, how many times do we hear that the survivors of a crime, or their sons or daughters in particular, or parents, a loved one, has been tragically taken, and the perpetrator did it belligerently, purposefully, and they don't have closure until the person who has committed the crime is exposed and condemned and held accountable. And that's exactly what's happening here. The United States lit the fuse that is going to start the Magog War. It already did. The invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and the Syrian war. It's all America's fault. And America has supplied hundreds of billions of dollars of its most advanced weapons to the Muslims who wield them against Israel. And America is at the forefront of the Land for Peace deal that is going to dissect Israel. And so collectively, for a whole host of reasons, it's America that is responsible for the most devastating attack in the history of God's chosen people. And so he can't just let it go. He can't even say, I'm going to wipe them out and we'll just all forgive and forget. The victims and the survivors deserve accountability. That's why there's so much in judgment. The leaders of the various religious and political and militaristic organizations that have harassed God's people over the years are all going to be brought to judgment. They're going to have to bow down before God, quivering in their boots, and we're going to witness them being judged. We're going to witness the trial of Hadrian and Paul and Muhammad, Cardinal Pell, and a host of others, because they have to be held accountable for God to be just, for him to be fair, for him to heal his people. And so in this particular passage it says, but he will rebuke them, issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. So God's going to explain what it is that they did that was wrong. The world is unwilling to recognize what's wrong with Islam. They don't understand why Islam creates 99% of the world's terrorist acts. They can't even make that common connection, that common denominator in Islamic terror and Islamic religion. But God's going to make it for us. He's not going to just wipe them out. In fact, most of these people aren't going to be wiped out. They're going to a place of alienation. And for that, there has to be a trial. And so you're going to see God say, this is what you did wrong. All it was Satan.
That used to disturb me that you didn't, that you wanted to watch that, and I kind of didn't. I've totally turned over differently, a new leaf now. I want to be there. I think it's got to be. It's got to be done. I mean, I'm totally on your
side. It's
got to
be done. Yeah,
it's got to be done.
Yeah, it's as hard as it was because it's really in your face, and yes, I hate to, particularly pertinent to America.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so many things America has done with its manifest destiny, its replacement theology.
Yeah.
So many things that America has done that have been horrific, while bragging about, you know, being God's people.
Arrogant. Yeah, we're the most arrogant people I've ever. You don't find anybody in history as bad as we are.
Yeah. And so it needs to be done. Now, you know, once it's done, we will forget about it. We're never going to forgive, and they're going to spend their eternity in Sheol, and so be it. But it needs to be done. So let's begin the beginning and talk about some of these words that are in this stunningly important passage, because this is the rebuke and obliteration of Islam. They'll, from this point on, the forces of Babel are going to include other nations and institutions, because the religion that was born and bred outside of Babylon will be no more. So it begins with this word, Laom, which we will still spend considerable time dissecting because of what we can learn about Laom. Laom is a very unique word for people. It's a very unique word for nation. You know, normally nation is goyim. You know, the Gentile nations is goyim, distinct from Yisrael. And people is usually am, which can be people related by ethnicity. But people are country, am, and nation, goyim. And you know, if it's talking about individuals, they're ish. Men, they're Adam.
Yes.
Mortals, Enosh. Now, there's lots and lots of words that God has to describe these things, and one that he uses very infrequently is Laom. And so it's really important for us to say, well, how does it differ from these others? And what you find is Laom talks about people massing together under a single religious and political leader. It's a population groups which gather politically or religiously, and are unified by a governmental leader or a religious leader, and they are actually transformed in some way by them. That's Laom.
Yeah.
Like widespread and innumerable Rabbim, you know, Rabbi is based upon great,
greater,
enormous, massive, abundant, extensive, excessive. Well, this is the plural of it. Widespread and innumerable. And then Sheol. Sheol is one of several Hebrew words which describe Sheol, present the concept of a black hole, speak of that which is horribly destructive and deadly, corrupting and confusing. And so, a full, amplified definition of Sheol would be corrupting and confusing, rebellious and brawling, uproarious and chaotic, presumptuous and mocking, political and religious, that which is ensnarled by Sheikh Shaul, the founder of the Christian religion, and trapped in Sheol, that which is depressed, horribly destructive and deadly. And that is the nature of these floodwaters. You know, the floodwaters, this is not a flood. There's no water here. Floodwaters, ma'am, is a metaphor. You know, it's these are these destructive and deadly jihadists are coming into Yisrael in such numbers at such a rate that they are like floodwaters in the sense that they're unstoppable, and like floodwaters in the fact that they're deadly and destructive. And God says that they will be devastating and desolating. Well, desolating is the polite term for a lot of people are going to die. To be desolate is to be lifeless, to be without life. So devastating and lifeless. Shah. And what's interesting here is the way that it was written, because it was written in the Nephil imperfect paragogic, which means that habitually these jihadists are destroyed as they lay waste. So they're perpetrating this and affected by it, the Nephil stem, acquiescing to the will of the one that is driving them. So the imperfect is ongoing. The paragogic says that they are acquiescing. They are giving up their free will
to
the one who is motivating them, which would be Allah, Satan. But then he will rebuke them. This is God. Issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. This is Gahar Bahu. He will disapprove and reprimand them, accusing them of wrongdoing, exposing and admonishing them by explaining the errors in their ways, and in an insulting manner while angrily censuring them. Now, this is the thing that I've come to embrace, and that I think that the more we attempt to follow Yahweh's example, at least in the things we can do, the better. You know, I can't blow my spirit out and cause bad people to blow away and leave innocent people safe. I can't do that. But I can do this. I can rebuke the religion of Islam. I can issue a warning against the religion of Islam. I can criticize the corruption that is Islam. I can disapprove and reprimand Muhammad and the Quran. I can accuse Muhammad of wrongdoing, expose him, and explain the errors in his way. And I can put that into words that are written and spoken. I can do that. And if I'm doing that, guess what? I'm doing what God himself is going to do. And I don't think there's any chance in the universe that if we are doing something that God is committed to doing and that he has done throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, we're in pretty good position with that. There's no chance we're going to displease God with that. And, you know, the choice between pleasing God and pleasing man, I'd just as soon please God, even if it means displeasing man.
Good choice.
Yeah. So, and the other thing is that this Gahar comes with an attitude, an insulting manner. I'm insulting. In Prophet of Doom, I wrote to be disparaging. Muhammad's despicable. Despicable rapist and pedophile. Mass murderer and thief. Who claimed divine inspiration only to satiate his own lust for sex, power, and money. He's despicable. The religion he created is disgusting. We should feel good about insulting and mocking and deriding that which is not only untrue, but disharmful and laughably stupid, but yet criminally destructive. And so Yahweh says, and they will be driven away, denied and deprived of what they have sought. They shall disappear. Came up with a solution to Islamic terrorism 15 years ago. Hasn't changed. It's the only solution that will actually work. isolation.
Mm-hmm. Quarantine.
Quarantine. Isolation. You know, it isn't our job to tell people that they can't be a Muslim. You want to be a Muslim? Be a Muslim. Stupid. It's just like, I want free will on the drug use. You want to use cocaine? Stupid. It's your choice. Don't destroy your life. You know, if you want to destroy your life, is your life that miserable? Go for it. I think it's stupid. But you ought to be free to do it. I was in homes today with a Christian, and we explained there was no Jesus then on, and that I'm not a Christian because, well, Paul contradicted everything God said and stood for. And it was like, you know, I was Beelzebub to her. I couldn't process it. And this is a really nice lady, but couldn't process it. You want to be religious? That's your choice. I don't care. But if your religion inspires 99% of the world's terrorist acts, then I don't want it.
I feel the need to speak out and condemn it.
Right. I don't want it threatening those that I care about and love. I don't want it. I don't want to import something that deadly and put innocent people at risk. So it should be isolated and quarantined. Don't sell them weapons. Don't let them migrate into the country. Export those who are fundamentalists. That's just the reality of it. It's the only solution that will work. That happens to be the solution God is using here. He swiftly drives them away. He denies and deprives them of what they sought, such that they disappear. The forced to flee, depart. No longer existing in their previous form. So, that is God's solution. Once again, if our solution is the equivalent of his, we're in good shape. Now, we've got to be careful here.
Yes.
We do not and should never have the choice over life and death. In other words, I can use my words to explain this is what's wrong with Muhammad and Islam. This is the connection between Islam and terrorism. This is why we ought to quarantine and isolate ourselves from fundamentalist Islam. But when it comes to forcibly removing someone, or worse, what this moron did, shooting people, we do not have that right. We're limited to our words and should only be using our words. You will always make it worse if you go beyond using your words. In the case for harming another person, even killing them, is so narrow that the vast preponderance of people won't experience a situation where it would be justified, even if they had 10 lifetimes. And in my view, the only place it's justified is if you are witnessing a person who is in the act of trying to harm to the point of debilitate or kill someone you know and love who is a completely innocent victim, and that the person is, that it is impossible to stop the perpetration of that crime any other way, and that by engaging in this way, you have a high likelihood, a very high likelihood, of sparing the life of the innocent person being harmed. Under those circumstances, if you're actually absolutely certain that that is what you're witnessing, then under those circumstances, there's a justification.
And we have an example of that, Moshe.
Yeah,
Moshe.
Before
he left.
Yeah, Moshe before he left. He watched a Egyptian taskmaster beating a person to death.
Yeah.
And so Moshe stopped him, taking his life.
Yahweh never brought it up.
Yeah, and I don't, it wasn't Moshe's attempt to murder him. It wasn't his attempt. He wanted to stop him. And God never brought it up. There's that case down in Texas where a man saw one of his farm employees raping his, I think it was an 8-year-old daughter. And picked up a board to knock him away, and ended up killing him. He didn't intend to kill him. He just intended to stop him. And, of course, I mean, there would be rage, righteous indignation, and I'm sure he didn't tap him on the shoulder. Hey, may I please have your attention?
Yeah, I mean, I'd
do the same thing. Of course, there wasn't a judge in Texas that would take that case. I'm sorry. You're not going to be. Not going to go to trial. So there are circumstances, but they're few and far between. You know, this idea that that you know our snipers are heroes because they've killed 100 Islamic terrorists because they don't know who they're killing.
Yeah.
But they're killing somebody in war. Yeah. What was the purpose of killing Japanese soldiers on Iwo Jima? What was the purpose of killing Vietnamese soldiers on Hamburger Hill? What was the purpose of killing German soldiers in the trenches in World War One? What was the purpose of killing Indians in the Indian Wars? What was the purpose of that? So you have to be really careful. What was the purpose of killing Vietnamese? I mean, I don't know. What's the purpose of it? What was the purpose of going into Iraq and Afghanistan and killing hundreds of thousands of people? It's very, very seldom do you have justification for taking another life. You know, in all of our drone attacks, where we've killed tens of thousands of people with our drones over the last 20-some-odd years, you know, there's never actually been a trial for any of those people.
Of course not.
And there's not a single one of those people that we've killed with drones that have actually killed an American, taken an American life.
Mm-hmm. Well, we invade whole countries that don't do that, like Afghanistan.
Correct. Afghanistan. There wasn't a single Afghani that took an American life or participated in 9/11. There wasn't a single Iraqi. Astonishing. So he's going to rebuke them, issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption. And they will be swiftly driven away, deprived of what they had sought, and they shall disappear, going away to a distant place of alienation. Now that one's that is something that we can talk about. We can say with virtual certainty that Paul and Hadrian and Muhammad, Cardinal Pell, the current pope, every pope, is going to go away to the distant place of alienation, is going to spend eternity in Sheol. Because God has given us the criterion, we can apply the criterion, we say this is the result, and yet we're not sending them there.
No.
It's way above our pay grade. All of these trials where God will be trying the individual to determine whether or not their soul is extinguished or sent to Sheol, not our job. We are not the judge. Yahweh's the judge. Now, we may get to participate in providing evidence, although I'm sure Yahweh can do a fine job.
Do that on
those malach that he is assigned to the job. But he may allow us to participate. We're not issuing the judgment. And we're incapable of sending a soul to Sheol. But God's going to send a lot of them there. These souls are going to a distant place of alienation. Men, Merchak, removed and separated into a location which is far away. He's not just blowing them out of the land and back into Jordan and Syria. Saudi Arabia. He's taking him to a distant place of alienation, Sheol. And they will be chased just as the chaff on the hills. Now, the chaff on the hills.
Mm-hmm.
Chaff is the worthless husks. It's the part of the grain that is discarded and easily blown away. You know, the wind is often a synonym for satanic and demonic spirits. And the chaff is the part that's just blown away. It's dried up. It's lifeless. blown away and essentially gets mixed with the dirt and is gone, ceases to exist. It's only the useful kernel that is spared. This even says this interesting word, Radoff, suggests that they're going to be hunted down, they'll be hounded, they'll even be harassed before they vanish. I saw one of the television shows I actually like. It's called Bull. I don't know if any of you ever watch Bull, but it's a story about a television series about a guy that's a jury consultant. And Michael Weatherly plays the main character. And the last one that I saw happened to be an episode that a woman murdered, cold blood, the man who murdered her daughter and who had raped her one daughter and murdered the other. Cold blood just took her life. And he defended her. And she was ultimately had all charges dismissed against her. This is useless chaff. And the reason I brought her up is before she took the life of the murderer and rapist of her daughters, she identified him, she identified herself, and she said, "This is why I'm doing this to you." And that's what, she hunted him down. That's what this word says, that God's going to hunt them down. He's going to hound them. He's going to harass them before they vanish. Consequence. And this is on the hills, upon the elevated heights and mountains, before the approaching presence of the Spirit. So it's the Spirit of Yahweh. The Spirit of Yahweh works a lot of different ways. It was the Spirit of Yahweh. The next chapter, we're going to talk about the Song of the Sea and how the Spirit blew up a wall of water that enabled the Israelites to pass that then came crashing down on the Egyptian army. The Spirit of Yahweh is used in episodes like this because the Spirit can interact in our 3D world. And the Spirit's effect on them is such a marvelous word, and it's a word that we will go into in quite some detail because we can learn a lot based upon this word. The Spirit is going to blow them away like a rolling ball of idolatrous dung, spinning like a tumbleweed in a whirlwind. Well, whirlwind is circular, the circular reasoning of satanically inspired texts. Paul's writings, for example, the Quran. The tumbleweed is not just a weed. It's hard and dry and just blows across lifeless territory. Spinning, dizzying, and idolatrous dung. It's a lot of references to dung throughout, lots of reference to these people. So whirling chariot wheels would fall into this. And it's the root is galal, which means dung, galul, which means religious idols, Golgath, which means skull, Galil, which is circuitous, Galah, which is to expose, to reveal, and to remove, and Galal, to roll away, before the approaching presence of the storm, Juba, a blowing gale, a tempest, a wind which spins around, and also Chuf, depicts the Gulf of Aqaba, where the Egyptian army drowned while pursuing the children of Israel, thereby tying this together and bringing our attention to the Song of the Sea as it is presented in Shemoth Exodus. So, this is now the second occurrence of Laom. These people, these nations, who are massing under a single religious or political leader. It's acronizing quality speaks of people who are changed, altered, and transformed, becoming different under this leader. In other words, so many Americans will go off and sign up for perform military duty following something like 9/11 or the Pearl Harbor attack. And while they're in boot camp, they're transformed.
Mm-hmm.
Something different. Immediately after we complete our analysis of Yashar 17, I'm going to turn our attention to Laom. We're going to see where it leads. And what we know of this Laom is that it's the massing of people under a particular leader, that they will be widespread, they'll be innumerable, and they will be shalom, horribly destructive and deadly, corrupting and confusing. There are going to be morons that are either ensnared by Shaul or trapped and drawn into Sheol. So this is occurring at the height of the time of Jacob's troubles, when Israel is encompassed by Sha'ah, devastating lifelessness, as a result of those who have capitulated to the will of Allah. You'll notice, though, that Yahweh isn't asking us to stop them, even if we could. You know, and this is there's a gazillion differences between what we're asked to do by God, what we're asking others to do, and what that idiot did in New Zealand. God isn't condemning these people based upon their race. He isn't condemning immigrants, as this Nimrod did. He isn't getting his news from the internet and from conspiratorial sources. He's not broadcasting it in an artificial realm called Facebook. He's not identifying with the most heinous group of people in modern history, the Nazis. He's not asking us to take up arms. He's not asking us to engage. He's not asking us to stop them. No, this is a different time. It's a different situation than anything else before. God is going to intervene, something he has not done for 20 centuries, and he's going to do it his way. You know, he's going to rebuke them openly, bluntly criticizing their corruption, exposing them for their ignorance and immorality. Then he's going to deny them what they saw, swiftly driving them away. And third, he's going to mend Merchak, remove them from his land, taking them to a place of separation. This is exactly as it should be. This is something that God cannot do regularly, because if he did, he would eliminate free will. But if he didn't do it here, he would not be able to fulfill his promises to Israel, because they would destroy the land of the people. Go ahead, I interrupted you guys. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just agreeing with you.
No, you're good.
In this war, the odds in human terms are just too great. Muslims are going to outnumber Israelites 100-1. 1.5 billion to 15 million. Equally revealing, while Israel has successfully defended itself against the unified rage of Islam in 1948, 1967, and 1964. This time, between 2027 and 2029, they will no longer have the capacity to do so. It's not just the numbers. It's American weapons that's going to turn the tide. Requiring Yahweh to intervene.
You know,
as has been noted, over the past decade, the United States has provided 25 times more military hardware to the Islamic nations than it has to Israel. And these are odds that cannot be overcome humanly.
Mm-hmm. If I can interject, there's not a single, in all of Islam, there's not a country, there's not a single truck factory or anything. They can't do anything if we don't give them trucks, if we don't give them refineries.
Correct.
If we don't give them
cars. Yeah, they manufacture nothing.
They got nothing. I mean, so
right.
Who's to blame here? I mean, who's going to...
Can you tell me what airplanes have been designed and manufactured in the Islamic world?
They couldn't build a biplane.
How about guided missiles?
Are you kidding? Nothing.
Nothing.
IEDs. They're good at those.
Yeah, but even on the IEDs, the materials they're using for the IEDs are comfortable with.
It's manufactured somewhere. A pressure cooker is manufactured by somebody else.
Right, yeah. Correct. Or, you know, their cell phone is set off by cell phones, or they're set off by pressure plates. They're not even making those. If we stopped giving them weapons, then they would be left to stick stones and, you know, maybe some knives and some swords. And I'm not even sure they'd make good knives and swords. But they wouldn't have guns. They wouldn't have ammunition. They wouldn't have rockets and missiles and bombs.
And they certainly wouldn't be a threat.
They wouldn't be a threat. There'd be no way for them to board airplanes and fly them into our buildings as they did with 9/11.
Yeah.
They wouldn't. They would be a threat to themselves. We can't solve that. It's horrid what they have done. But we can't solve that. Anti-Semite rage is also going to escalate worldwide, as will mankind's propensity through propaganda and patriotism to turn this regional religious conflict into a global war. Anti-Jewish rhetoric is already on the rise in Europe. In fact, it may have reached pre-World War II levels. And it's also on the rise in the Americas. It may even, and that's one of the things which is so sad, not only about this, the Muslim congresswoman who with her anti-Semitic remarks, is the Democratic censure said that it shouldn't be hate speech even against Islam. And she says something horrific about Jews, and those who would speak out against the world's most deadly religion now are censured. That's why what happened in New Zealand was such a tremendous tragedy, because it works against the truth.
Yeah.
But anti-Jewish rhetoric is rising rapidly, and it may even lead to a nuclear holocaust with Iran, Pakistan, and/or Saudi Arabia initiating the carnage, and America responding, drawing in Russia and China and Europe. And toward the conclusion of this war, there will also be a series of devastating natural disasters, asteroid strike, for example. It's going to be hell on Earth. This is a terrible time. And it is not a tribulation in the Christian sense, although the word tsar, the time of Jacob's troubles, its troubles tsar can be stretched to tribulation. But it's that which is really adversarial, that which is terrorizing, that which is destructive and desolating. And I can't tell you if the time of Jacob's troubles is 7 years, 3.5 years, 3 years, 5 years, but it's within that framework, and what we really don't know is the entire time. The time of Jacob's troubles and just grows in intensity towards the end. But God is concerned about this. I know this is not a Christian mantra because they never think of Israel. It's just the tribulation, and it's a worldwide tribulation. God's only concerned about one place. He's going to tell us about other nations interacting against Israel. The only place he cares is it's the time of Jacob's troubles. Now, this next statement is mind-blowing in terms of the realization that this was written around 700 BCE. This was written 1,400 years before the Islamic religion was created, before the first jihadist killed a Jew. 1,400 years before the first jihadist would celebrate killing Jews, screaming Allahu Akbar. And if it wasn't for the fact that we can say for absolute certain that this is a translation of a document that was found in its entirety, that was copying from an earlier document, 250 BCE.
Yeah, 2,200 years.
Fully 1,000 years before Islam would exist, and 2,200 years before there would be the Arab awakening that this describes. It says, approaching the timing, nearing the point in time and occasion upon the season for the events of the noxious religious disorder and mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset.
Amazing.
Then behold, terror. There's more to this statement, but let's just start with this. I shouldn't be laughing for multiple reasons. One is my ribs.
This is just horrible.
Oh my goodness, this is powerful. Approaching the timing, La'ath, nearing the point in time, and the season of these events, Arab, and it can be pronounced as A-R-A-B or Arab, E-R-E-B, written exactly the same way in the Hebrew text. Mm-hmm. I have a slight intermission for a moment. A friend who listens to the show a lot sent me an article. It's a book that I will read. I wouldn't advise others to buy it. It's supposed to be pretty pedantic, and it's very expensive to buy. But you can read reviews of the man's work. And he himself is a lost scholar, theological seminary grad that works in a religious seminary. But what he did is prove conclusively that the first alphabet was Hebrew. And scholars have known for a long time that the single most difficult thing that to ever appear as an invention in humanity was a written phonetic alphabet. Nothing is more important in terms of communicating information and teaching and for a society being able to grow and to learn from one another and to learn from past generations, to pass on information. There's nothing anywhere close to the power and importance of written language. Nothing. And scholars have known that it's only been invented once. And they knew that it had been invented around where Israel is today. And they want to give the Phoenicians credit because the Phoenicians sound cool.
And they're not Jews.
And sometimes they want to give other cultures that are no longer around, that were just inland of the Phoenicians, credit. But the alphabet's Hebrew.
Yeah.
And it should have been easy because we don't have much in written text for the Phoenicians. And we got almost nothing from these other cultures. In fact, they're for the most part, they're only known because of the text of the Torah prophets and Psalms. And yet we have the most detailed, the most comprehensive, the most historically accurate written account in Paleo-Hebrew in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And these scholastic idiots couldn't figure it out. Well, this fellow has. Perfect. He's gone through and said, yeah, there's some evidence that this was used in early Phoenicia. There's some evidence that the Babylonians and the Assyrians migrated from the Sanskrit to essentially this alphabet in Akkadian. You can see it. But when it all comes back, it only fits one community, Israel. So when we've been saying that man's single greatest achievement isn't man's achievement at all. It's God's gift. The Hebrew language. There's absolute proof of that being the case. So this says the noxious religious disorder and the mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset. Amplified Arab means of the rising up of the Arabians. even the evening of foreigners, the night of religious upheaval, when many intermingle and make a pledge to join in and participate in something extremely toxic, dark, and deadly. The close of the day, when things grow dark, with the arrival from the desert of foreign people who are aroused from a cultural wasteland. Arab, which means Arab, Arabian, desert wasteland, to mix together and to make a pledge to join in and participate together, creating religious disorder and Arab, sundown night and foreign people, as well as Oreb, noxious flies, are written identically in the Paleo-Hebrew text. From Ur and Ur, meaning to be roused and to be awakened. But think of that. Of the obnoxious religious disorder in mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset. Then behold, pay very close attention. Look now and see them right here. Terror. Ba'Allah. In the name of Allah. Enormously dreadful and fear-inducing terrorism. The shock and awe of calamitous destruction perpetrated on civilians by armed militants. Sudden and startling destruction by terrorists who have long enjoyed and take great pleasure in perpetrating heinous acts of terror which result in the cessation of life and physical decomposition in the name of Allah, which seeks to oppress through domination from Allah to make afraid and to dishearten the will of others by totally enjoying and using to the fullest the desire to inflict the severe distress and dreadful trouble associated with terrorism and Baal to mix together and commingle to confuse and confound. How about those apples?
That's amazing. That's totally amazing.
Approaching the time of the noxious religious disorder and mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset, of the rising up of the Arabians, the evening of foreigners, the night of religious upheaval. Then behold, terror. Enormously dreadful, fear-inducing terrorism. The shock and awe of calamitous destruction perpetrated on civilians by armed militants. All in the name of Allah. That's sobering, isn't it?
Okay. I mean, I can hear Obama's speech about the Arab awakening. I mean, we lived through it the last few years ago. It wasn't that long ago when they were rise up and take your place, you know, do your time. Dang.
So God is saying that is exactly what
calling it the Big Bang.
It's like, yeah, we're calling it the Big Bang. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's for those that don't know, in the creation account, the first use of the term Big Bang was Yahweh. He described the creation event as the Big Bang. In the time before the dawn, this large migration of asses and the consideration of such things, Bokur Bakar, the morning of inspection and perception, the arrival of the light, to be observant and judgmental regarding these herds of animals, the sunrise and daybreak the next morning after the religiously inspired and clandestine sacrifice whose implications elicit an appropriate response. They are no more. They're gone. Negated. They are for naught because they fail. There are no more questions. Declarations are propositions. It's all over. This is the fate of those deceived by seductive words. The consequence of their choices. Chalek. This is what happens as a result of flattering, misleading, and pervasive propaganda which promotes wrongdoing, the ruinous reward and allotment of those seeking territory based on lies, the devastating share of what is apportioned to those who have been seduced by sexual, suggestive speech, errant opinions, and illegitimate praise. Of the marauders who plunder and pillage us, and the allotment and retribution of those who seek to conquer us, carrying off the spoils of war because they despise us. I don't know what's better, that opening line about approaching the timing of the noxious religious disorder and mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset, and then behold terror of what we just read. God is committed to blowing them away, to removing them from the land. He is committed to that plan that we have discussed so many times, isolation and quarantine. In the time before the dawn, this large migration of asses and the consideration of such things, they are no more. They're gone. And they have to be gone. All traces of militancy and religion and politics all have to disappear before the earth can be transformed back into the conditions of Eden. And these militants, who are overtly religious, are the first to go. They are no more. And then God's very clear. This is the fate of those who have been deceived by seductive words. This is the consequence of their choices. It's what happens when you believe flattering and misleading and pervasive propaganda. It's what happens when you engage in wrongdoing and this manner, when you seek the territory of others, particularly when your basis is a pile of lies. If you've been seduced by sexually suggestive speech.
Really, you know.
I mean, think of, you know, we know in Islam they're promised, you know, the 72 virgins, and the Quran routinely talks about the virginal reward for jihadists that die killing for Allah. Everybody knows that. But you know, and that's what he's speaking of here. So God is saying, yeah, he read the Quran more than 1,000 years before it's written. And he said, this is the fate of those who were beguiled by such nonsense. But what I was going to say is that there's a subtlety to this in the United States military.
Mm-hmm.
There's a subtlety to the idea of being a warrior and appealing to women and how they, you know, in a sporting event, they'll unite a soldier and their wives, and how they'll show, you know, soldiers with pretty women, and how they show the Marines in their handsome uniforms and present them as being sexually attractive, strong, you know, as like they're some kind of a hero and athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And sure. In the U.S. military, where sexual perversion is a mainstay, where a woman is like 7 times more likely to be sexually abused than she would be in any civilian organization in the country, and where 99% of sexual predators in the military are not convicted. There is this undercurrent of have what you want. So it exists other places besides just Islam. In the time before the dawn, this large migration of asses and concentration of such things, they are no more. The fate of those deceived by seductive words, this is the consequence of their choices, of the marauders who plunder and pillage. And it's pillage us. God speaking here.
His people.
These are his people.
Yes.
This is his land.
His family, yeah.
You know, when you're working against God by trying to impose a two-state solution, a land for peace solution, you're pillaging what belongs to Yahweh. You're pillaging His people. God takes it personally. This is the marauders who plunder and pillage us. And the allotment and retribution to those who seek to conquer us, carrying away the spoils of war because they despise us. That's a huge part of the motivation in academia, in politics, in religion, and in the military, for the overall hatred and resentment of Israel. There are a lot of Jewish traits that today that are reprehensible. And I look at the religious Jews, their little black outfits, their black hats, their black jackets, and their black pants, and little black shoes, and their little curly Q, and they're feminine. They're so feminine, and they do nothing but wallow in their perverted religion all day. They're reprehensible. And they force their women to wear wigs or cover their head. The women have no right. You know, a woman in rabbinic Islam can't even divorce her husband until her husband says, it's okay, you can divorce me, otherwise she can never remarry. I mean, religion exists for men to abuse women. Always has. But, yeah, there's a lot of reasons to despise God's chosen people. Right at the moment, God may even despise them. But it's a really bad idea.
Because God still loves them. You can't. Yeah, we don't do that.
Yeah, He's going to deal with them. Yeah. Yes. We can openly speak of the things that irritate God about them.
Sure.
No, God does, so we can. But He's going to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than the Arab Spring, this is the Arab sunset, the ultimate consequence of Islam's destructive and deadly nature. The word Arab, meaning the lack of light, is indistinguishable in the Hebrew lexicon from Arab, the desolate places and race universally associated with Islamic terrorism. As a result of Islam, Arab and Muslim are considered synonymous and thus indistinguishable. And speaking of indistinguishable, there is no distinction between Islamic ambitions and behavior and what has been foretold throughout this prophecy. Muslims reaffirm it every day. The prophecies of them through Ishmael, that they were accurate. Their hand is raised against their brother. Their brother's hand is raised against them. And they live in hostility with the entire world. Arab and Arab vividly foretell the rising up of the Arabians, a time of foreign invasion, a night of religious upheaval, when many will intermingle and make a pledge to join in, promoting the mantra of the world's most toxic and deadly religion. Things will grow especially dark when these desert dwellers are aroused from their cultural wasteland and swarm into the land like foxes, flies. Now, not only is Arab synonymous with darkness and death, Allah's name is found in the midst of the Hebrew word terror, Ba'Allah. We should not be surprised. Muslims following Allah's Quranic orders are responsible for 99% of the world's terrorist acts. So Yahweh just revealed Arab Henna Ba'Allah. Arab equals terror in the name of Allah. And He did so, committing this prophecy to writing 1,350 years before Muhammad promoted Allah's black stone out of the Kaaba's pantheon of 365 Arabian rock gods and transformed previously peaceful Arabs into Islamic terrorists. If you're receptive, thoughtful, informed, and rational, the implications of what we have just considered are transformational. And speaking of such, considering how Muhammad and his satanic influence, Allah, changed Arabs. We have yet another indication as why Allah, or excuse me, Yahweh, selected Laom, people who are transformed under a single leader or influence, to describe them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are lots of times when we do this show or I write in these complete chapters where I feel like the world's least appropriate tool. Thank you. Oh my God, you could do a lot better than me to convey this message. And there are times like this where God is specifically talking about Islam and Allah and Muhammad and Islamic terrorism and what the world's going to behold against Israel. Well, I realize that because of being led to the truth through the lie that is Islam, I'm amongst the most qualified people God could find. Not because he found me that way, but because he made me that way.
Mm-hmm.
The prophet of doom, Tiamat Daris, were prerequisites for being able to do this job well.
Yeah. Yeah,
I dare say that so many of the things, like questioning Paul, having been a Christian leader, an elder ordained in the Presbyterian Church, and having been an evangelist, Bible study teacher, without that exposure and experience, I don't think we could have written Questioning Paul. I don't think I would have understood how this book began with the sixth proverb exposing Pauline Christianity, or where we are now. If it hadn't been for the fact that I was once a pro-military, patriotic, political person, flying my flag and, you know, America, love it or leave it, I don't think I would have understood why God is so averse to us being political and religious. Sometimes I think that it is the flaws, it's the mistakes of the past that really position us to be able to contribute to what God's once done, as opposed to just being a robot. And God doesn't use robots. He Moshe wasn't a robot. Moshe did a lot of bad stuff, and he was in all likelihood an Egyptian general.
Mm-hmm.
He was certainly part of the Pharaoh's family. He was up to it to his eyeballs before he left. But it was that understanding of it that made him such that there was actually some synergism between he and Yahweh. Because Yahweh does not want to work alone. He wants to work through his creation. That's the purpose of creation, was to create productive relationships and do things together. And so God does pick people where there is some synergism. And you might say, why would you need synergism when the inspiration is God, who's, you know, so much more brilliant than we can even imagine? No. Because what would there be in it for God, for Yahweh, if man couldn't make a contribution?
Mm-hmm.
Moshe made a contribution. Read the Barim. Dode made a contribution. Read his Psalms, the Mizmor. You know, in a very small way, I think the willingness to understand Islam and the mistakes I made in Christianity and being political made some of these insights synergistic. A lot more enjoyable, I think, for Yah. Because he didn't have to explain everything. It was just like Moshe. He didn't have to explain everything to Moshe. He got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you read things like Ba'ala, it's immediately revealing.
Yeah.
You know that it presents more than just terror. You know it's direct tie to Allah. And you understand that Muslims celebrate death. You know, the Quran, I know, is a cesspool of pagan lore. It's a bastardized twisting of the Talmud. Even a corruption of New Testament stories. In conjunction with a thriving terrorist mentality. And Bala's a mixing together and commingling of barbarian and religious notions designed to confuse and confound. Islam rules by Bala, fear, disheartening the will of others in the cruelest and most perverted way, whereby the belligerents are seen totally enjoying their sadistic behavior, revealing an unrestrained desire to glorify terrorism, death, oppression, anti-Semitism, and anti-feminism. We've come a long way.
Yeah, well,
and Kirk had the opportunity to read these last two chapters,
yeah,
the closing chapters of Volume 2, 12 and 13. Even Jackie, who does such a wonderful job editing, she wrote me the other day and said, you know, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
We up all night.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just can't put it down. It's so timely. The insights are so important. We're learning so much, and so it is a marvelous time.
Well, you know,
one of the things I learned that I didn't know previously, and we're going to learn about this in the next chapter,
mm-hmm,
is that the neck is the presentation of Dode's insights and words. That when Dode is explaining the purpose of the neck, the sign and banner that Yah was lifting up, and he's going to lift it up in the next chapter to call Jews out of America home. And he's lifting it up in America. He's telling Jews around the world, and he's telling Jews living in Israel, because they need to accommodate them, because it's going to double the Israeli population. And he's telling them all over the world, but it's in the context of his condemnation of America and just before the destruction of America. And he's raising the neck to convey this information. And so I was encouraged to look up every place neck was used. And one of the places I found was Mizmor Psalm 60. And so I translated it. And what I found was one of the most profoundly rewarding affirmations that I've come across in a long time. And I want to leave tonight's program with this thought, and we'll go into great detail of it in a future program. But when Dode is speaking of the neck being raised,
mm-hmm,
he says in first person that his purpose is so that you can respond to me, so that you can listen to me. The words on the neck are Dode's. The words on that sign that are being lifted up present Dode, David, as the person who is calling his people home. They aren't being called to recognize the Messiah. They aren't being called to Jesus Christ. They're being called by the most important Jew who ever lived. Dode. How long is the human experience, fellas?
Well, within the...
From Yahweh's perspective, how long is the human experience?
6,000 years.
7,000 years.
Correct. Yep. Oh, he's right.
6,000
years. No, you're right. 6,000 years. It's not 7,000 years. The last 7,000 years is us living with God. That's the kingdom of Dode. Okay. Early time. No, 6,000 years. From the time we were expelled from the garden to the time we're were let back into the garden.
Yes.
When did Dode live in that 6,000-year experience?
About the middle, didn't
he? Yeah, I'm going to say
not about
the middle. In the middle.
Yeah. Absolutely in the middle. 3,000 years from both ends. He's right at the heart of God's story about his people. He is the anointed of his people. He is the example of what it means to be in the covenant of his people. He is the most prolific writer of his people. Of all of the characters mentioned in the story in Yahweh's testimony, no one comes any more close to Dode in terms of what is written about him and what he himself has written. It's Dode that's calling his people home. The neck is comprised of words that have been written on behalf of Yehudim living in America and therefore in English to encourage them to listen to what Dode had to say so that they will leave this country before it's too late and come home to Yah. I don't know how long ago it was that we began. I was probably first, and I know I got a lot of flack for it initially. Mm-hmm. And now I think that there's a number of us that have come to realize that Dode's the most important person who ever lived.
Yeah.
And that it is when we really understand it, it's Dode that is calling to us, that's teaching us, guiding us. And then to read the neck, which we realize that, well, I hope there is something better that Yahweh lifts up as the neck than what we have done, but if he doesn't,
we're going to feel comfortable about it because Dode's already done it.
What Dode did, what he said, what he represents. And so it's a real affirmation that that we were right. We've been right for a long time.
Yeah.
The Dode did. There's no question that when that neck is being raised, Dode is speaking in first person, and he's pleading with his people to Anah, respond and answer him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Shema, listen to him. Well, that can't be done unless the words which are being conveyed explain who Dode is and what he is, what he represents.
Yeah.
And it's a concerted effort to be translating his testimony. So we're going to really get into some interesting material as we're taking a little, you know, we've done this a lot, but we're going to do it exponentially going forward. The third volume of these two chapters, and then the entirety of the third volume is going to be, rather than just going through a book like we've been going through Yahseyah, we're going to go through topics. And the next topic is the neck. We're going to go over everything we can learn about the neck, and the next is going to be what Babylon represents in the last days. And we're going to do so by looking at where the words are used, when they're used in Yirmiyah, Yahseyah, we spend a lot of time in both books, Zechariah, Malachi. So I think it's going to be a really interesting experience. Taking the words that are like neck, it's only used 22 times. Taking words like that. Taking prophetic references to Babel. I had no idea. And I had always realized the most adroit fit for Babylon in today's world is the fifth and final beast. The beast that grew out of the viciousness of Imperial Rome, the Roman Catholic Church. But there is a nation that represents Babel today. The United States.
That's interesting. That's right.
They control the money. They control the power. They control the military around
yep.
the world. They're the empire.
And what I found when I started traveling, translating things for this next chapter, not 13, but the first chapter of Volume 3, is that all the references to Babel are even more adroit describing the United States than Yesterday IET.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Not what I wanted to find either.
This is like, you know, you're like dead in the saddle. I mean, this is like already. I mean, you just
yeah.
Wow. I look forward to that.
And there's a lot of reasons for it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons for it. But we are the new Carthage, the new Rome.
Yeah.
We're the incarnation of Babel as a nation. As new Carthage, new Rome. So anyway, it's I think it's to look forward to because it's all along the way we're learning so much. We're having so many affirmations that Yahweh inspired these words and what he likes, what he dislikes, his the way he's going to respond to those who are religious versus those who have engaged in his relationship. It's and you know I find it. I know that it's to realize that terror in the name of Allah is being perpetrated on the world is a sad thing, but to read Ba'Allah in the text, following the Arab sunset,
mm-hmm.
a time of religious darkness, there's something so profound about that that. You know, I would say, okay, so the subject matter is dark. It's dark not because Yahweh wants it to be that way. It's dark because, well, that's what man is doing. And, you know, God told us this 2,700 years ago. So.
You know, if I can throw one last thing in there.
Yeah, please.
In reading this week, I had so many emotional swings. I had, number one, I was, some of it was just sad, like in 61. I mean, you just almost want to cry. And then you feel terrible that this, in a way because so much carnage is about to take place. And the third thing that kept going on is this is, I always knew this was real. I always knew the timeline and so forth. I mean, even as a Christian, I knew this is the generation and so forth. So Israel returns, so that's pretty focused in on a time. But it's like this is just coming so alive. I've just been... It's just wow moment after wow moment after wow moment. So it's riveting.
We are really being given a word's eye picture.
Yeah, very much.
Of what's going to occur.
Yeah. So.
And it is like reading today's newspaper, and if you're aware of what's happening, it's you realize that what God is describing is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just as certain as they've already been fulfilled.
Yeah, he can't stop it, and he wants to do these things so that they will know him. That's the big turning point for them, for the
Yehudim
that would be left behind.
Yeah, I was of the, I think I've made a wrong conclusion long ago, and I may have stated it sometime, and I'm going to want to clarify a position. I had thought that, you know, the whole idea of, quote, put unquote, now the tribulation was to make things so bad, that Jews in desperation finally recognize their only hope is Yahweh, and they turn to him out of just absolute desperation. I don't think God wants anybody to turn to him out of desperation.
No, that's kind of like,
And so I'm convinced that the this onslaught causes Jews to realize that their IDF can't protect them, that their government can't protect them, that the rabbis are useless in protecting them, and that that the ways of man are universally failed.
Yeah.
I think it's going to help from that point of view. But ultimately, the thing that causes Israelites to return to Yahweh and to come home isn't desperation. It's those words conveyed through the neck.
Yeah, Well, it's doing it for me.
That is what awakens them. That is the thing. It's why it comes up so many times and why it's in these kinds of prophetic packages. It's the thing that awakens them. And, you know, understand, it's not that big a deal because all it is a translation of Yahweh's testimony and an emphasis on what Dod had to say, with written in the lingua franca of particularly Yehudim, and Yehudim living in the West and particularly in America, where 72% of the non-Israeli population of Yehudim live currently. So it's, you know, it's no new revelation in it. It's just a presentation of what has always been there. But it's Dod calling them home.
Well,
because who's going to be the king of the millennial Shabbat?
Dod's
calling them home. Where's Dod's home going to be?
Down the hill.
Yeah, 777. Yeah. The Zion Way.
Zion Way.
Mount Moriah, Jerusalem, Yehuda, Israel. He's calling them home. Just as it should be. And one of the things that I've come to realize is that there is nothing that would ever cause Jews to accept Jesus. Nothing.
No.
Bogus name. Bogus message. And they've been accused for 2,000 years of murdering the Christian God. They've suffered enormously for the myth of having murdered the Christian God. And they know that the Christian Jesus bears no resemblance whatsoever to their God and his message. And so if they were being called to recognize the Messiah and to accept Jesus, it ain't never going to happen. It's way too much persecution in that name.
Too much history.
And so that was just such a profound revelation. They don't need to accept Amasiah. They don't need to accept Jesus, even by the right name.
Yeah.
They never do acknowledge Yahusha and the prophetic testimony. They're being called by King Dod, who is right, home. And it's the Jew of Jews, the Yahud of Yahud, the man right at the core of the human experience.
As it should be.
The best thing that ever happened to Israel, who's calling them home. And you know something? They can accept him. So
yeah.
They can listen to him. There should be no aversion to him. And of course, what could be more appropriate than after 2,000 years of not a single Yehudim willing to listen to him, willing to listen to Yahweh, willing to engage in this manner, that a totally unqualified Gentile says, "Can I introduce you to Dod? I'd like to make an introduction." You ought to think about it. You ought to consider what this guy had to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you read this?
Oh, yeah. Look over here.
Check it out yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of it is that the neck is being raised in America.
Yeah. Well, especially.
And that's where 72% of the non-Israelite Yehudim live today. And it's when you read Yirmiyah, and it's speaking of Babylon, God is saying, come out of her, otherwise you're going to receive her plagues. That's why the neck is being lifted here. God's people have to leave. So, fellas, it's been a lot of fun. I hope that I haven't been too pained here, and my voice being pained as I'm trying to deal with my ribs, but I've been doing this, leaning back on a bag of ice that is now completely melted, but hopefully that's helpful, and hopefully painful adjustment I have ever made. Because it wasn't my back, it was my ribs. And it reverberated through the room. This guy, even he, took this like leap back and said, "Oh my God, I've never heard that sound before." Oh, and it hurt. Oh, did it hurt? And even the therapeutic massage you have to move away the fluids and then to relax the muscles some, you know, where they need them, and to push really hard on them. You know, so I was in an hour of agony before he put me in serious agony. And I think I have to go back in tomorrow, so I may spend the early morning of the Shabbat imbibing some numbing secret sauce. No, I won't do that, but oh my. Do I really want to go through that again? Anyway, it was fun to complete the last chapter. I'll make some more edits of it as the typos continue to be corrected. I want to thank all of you who are contributing to that. And we'll do a final read-through of chapter 12, and I think we'll have another volume ready to go. And I think we're going to have a ball on volume 3.
Sounds like fun.
Good night, guys. Thank you.
Good night, y'all.
Have a good week. We'll be with you next week. Good night, y'all. Good night.